Society 13 Podcast Network. Redefining podcasts. Society-13.com.
I like to listen.
Welcome to Channel 9 of the STRY Radio Network, where stories live.
Before you listen to this podcast, be aware this show often uses very naughty language. If you don't like that, you shouldn't listen. Send your complaints to I Am a Whiny Baby with No Sense of Humor at nightstory.com or stop by the studio. I'll take you for a ride to a story of my choosing.
Welcome to the Ninth Story Podcast. I'm Immortal Alexander.
I am Jeanette Andromeda.
And today we have on author Trisha J. Woldridge.
A.K.A. T.J. Woldridge, A.K.A. Author I Stalk.
So we're going to start off the episode with a poem by Trisha, and then we're going to go right on to the interview. So enjoy that, and we'll be right back.
The Circus Under the Bed by Trisha J. Woldridge. What was that noise there neath your bed? Some whisper, hissed song now long fled. A skittering whirl of legsy-clack dread. Something real you fear, not just in your head. Sleep on. It's only the circus under your bed. Woke with a start, felt your heart stop. Asleep in a dream and then not. That special moment, from your special head, a figment was born, burst forth with a pop. And who, with luck, found the circus under your bed. Once, when the world was ever dark, fire was magic, dangerous spark. Nightmares were real, not just under the bed. Monster or mere shadow, there was no mark if a figment were friend or if on babes it fed. Fear weaves dark spells, whispers in hate. Figments and dreamers forged sad fate. Monsters from figments grew up neath the bed, and believing the fear did truth create, that dreamer's very gaze could kill figments dead. Dreamers make lies when spoken. Monsters simply childhood's token. Still, children fear monsters under the bed, and figments fear each dreamer awoken. Life hangs in the balance during checks neath the bed. Child dreamers are told nothing's there. Child figments are told always beware. Do not ask questions, obey rules instead. Fear lives and grows under the guise of care, making monsters of the circus under the bed. What dreamers forgot but is true. Figments do not mean to hurt you. Figments have families. Some even wed. They dance and play. That's what circuses do. Figments live just like us, only under the bed. Circuses are all over Earth. Any dreamer's dream can give birth. Each new figment knows to hide neath the bed and hope for a circus's protective mirth, to love them and keep them safe there under the bed. While circuses mean dreamers no harm, should a figment find no circus warm, cold and afraid, they do change in their dread. Loneliness works a most horrible charm. The figment becomes the monster under the bed. So from when good dreams you might stray, startle wake far from light of day, don't fear the noises you hear neath your bed. With love to whomever you pray, please ask that a circus may be under your bed. Interview, interview. That's what we do here on the Ninth Story. We like to scare you and educate you. That's totally a theme song from someone else. And I'm just in a very musical mood today. I don't know why, but welcome back from that lovely poem. And now let's actually talk to Trisha J. Woldridge. Welcome to the Ninth Story Podcast. This is episode 509, where we are interviewing the esteemed author, Trisha Woldridge. And yes, there's a D in that name. Make sure you pronounce it sirs and madams.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yay! So I feel like you have been one of the authors I've been internet stalking ever since. That was another one of the Rock and Shock interviews. Yeah. And I was just like, this person's
Thank
amazing.
You. Thank you.
She's been hanging out outside of your digital window for hours. Are you okay with that?
I'm okay with that.
Yay!
When I do interviews for the bookstore I work at, my other job, one of my questions for authors is, how can people follow you or otherwise stalk you in a non-creepy way?
Well, because these days we kind of want stalkers. We call them fans in a good way. At one point, fanatics were kind of a bad thing. But now, hey.
Yeah.
As long as you're waving the knife around in your bedroom and not in our bedroom, it's fine.
Okay. Yeah, I'm good with that.
That's the difference, guys. You're not a creepy stalker if the knife is in your own bedroom.
Right.
Please don't wave.
Although I have a pretty phenomenal collection of blades at my house anyway, so.
So.
And Jeanette's got a really point. Cool Vorpal blade. Vorpal blade replica from American Beauty's Alice. We have one on here somewhere.
Also in our bedroom. Yeah. Awesome. So I guess bedrooms are good places for.
Yes.
Weird quarter metallic pop just now.
That was me cough laughing into the microphone. Wow. I apologize. I will try not to do that again.
Sound like somebody like pistol whipped a pistol.
Sorry. I will try to be quieter. For once you can actually hear me. Hey.
So Trisha, why don't you tell us a little bit about your beginnings as a writer and what kind of style do you kind of stick to?
Well, my very, very beginnings as a writer, I like to say, go back to like elementary school, where we would get weekly vocabulary sentence assignments. And I would like be so thrilled with whatever the week's vocabulary assignment was that I'd be like, I'm going to make new sentences and I'm going to go show my mom. And so like, I always had that in me.
Nice.
And I managed to work in, like, I got, two AP credits for writing a novella in Spanish. I worked at the school newspaper in high school. So I pretty much always worked writing into everything. And my first like office job when I still did office work was at a investment company. And I finagled my way into rewriting a lot of the information for the phone call people and the representatives, because that was way better than talking with actual customers.
Indeed.
Hey, those call scripts are actually legitimately very helpful.
Yes.
Hey, here's the things I'm supposed to say. Come buy stuff.
Yes. So that made it easier. And also when you're dealing with like finances, the rules, what you can and cannot say for investments is very important because lawsuits and money.
Yay, lawsuits.
Yeah, we know all that stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We've worked in film for a while, so we definitely dealt with the legal aspect for that as well.
Yeah, it's scary. It's scary writing fiction, too. Well, I did journalism after that when I finally said I'm done with office work and I went back to school. I did all my credits for a master's and then I started getting paid for doing journalism work and writing about food, of all things.
Nice.
Who doesn't like food? And it also included like people sending me free samples of deli items and cheeses and sauces. So, you know, that was really cool. That's and whiskey. Awesome. I got whiskey.
What?
I know.
Sign me up.
Yeah. So I did all that for a while. And then I started editing as well, because I pretty much had always edited throughout that. So I'm like, hey, I've got a marketable thing. You want to give me money for it? And people said yes.
Nice.
And so that's how I really ended up getting, I started with journalism. I did online tutoring for 7 years, helping students write their papers. And then I edited the Dungeons and Dragons online massive multiplayer online role-playing MMORPG.
Nice.
That came out over 10 years ago now.
Wow. Good job.
And I've got between 50 and 60 novels that I've edited to this date.
Oh my gosh. So what does an average day look like for you? Because like just leading up to this interview at all, it seems like you're all, okay, maybe an average week might be easier to hear about. But I'm very curious.
An average week, let's see, I usually have at least one novel or editing project that I spend some time on each day. So I try and spread it out through days, and it actually ends up being one day is this, another mm-hmm. day is this, and another day is this. But my Mondays usually start at the bookstore, Annie's Bookstop of Worcester, where I do events planning, and I bring all the authors in to the bookstore and do our PR stuff, run our blog, and things like that. I try to keep Tuesdays my work-at-home day. Mm-hmm. I'm mostly successful at that. but that's when I actually clean out, like, the critter boxes. I have a bunny and a rabbit. Maybe do some dishes that have piled up over the weekend. I usually do critiques that are like hard paper critiques this day, and organize my desk, which, you know, sometimes is over my head piled.
Oh gosh.
Wednesday is an oftentimes like out of the house day. I have a riding lesson on Wednesdays. I have a horse too on top of all my stuff. So I go to the barn and get my exercise at the barn playing with my horse. Then I usually have like a writing date with a couple people where the point is to turn off the internet specifically to mm-hmm. get writing done. This coming tomorrow, I've got my critique group. I've got two different critique groups that I meet with as well to try and get feedback on my projects. So part of being able to do all that is to have a lot of accountability partners. Mm-hmm. So I have one phone accountability partner that I meet with, and we check in on each other every week. My writing groups make sure that I have fresh writing every time we meet. And then Thursday, Friday are either like going out of the house for meetings or going out and getting writing done. And I'm usually up till about 2 or 3 in the morning. And I usually wake by choice, if I have a choice in the matter, between 10 and midnight, 10 and noon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always have control over that.
Yeah.
And then Fridays, I actually have a morning date with my husband where we actually go to the chiropractor because we both carried like massive book bags and destroyed our backs as students and have breakfast. And then we start the day. And then the weekend is either conventions. On a rare occasion, I get to stay home and then catch up on a bunch more writing and editing,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little more cleaning. Cleaning's at the very, very bottom of the list, but
yeah. I like the idea of getting food sponsors. I did say this before, like a while ago, but we should totally contact like Dan Aykroyd and get some of that Crystal Head vodka. It's like, hey, just send us a case of that.
Oh yeah.
You know, anything horror themed food products, mm-hmm. and we'll just be drinking while we do the interviews, would be great.
Writer's Tears. Writer's Tears whiskey, which was actually pretty good.
Nice.
I was at a convention where there was a bunch of scotch drinkers, and the idea is you all bring different scotches and we share.
Nice.
And I'm all for that. I'm a big fan of scotch.
Nice. Noted.
Scotch down in my belly.
Yes.
So I love how you've built your life around this passion you have of writing and just like keeping yourself constantly moving forward on so many different things and editing and everything. I don't know what that was going into other than just, damn.
I'm just right now.
There's still times I fail where I miss deadlines and stuff like that. And that like kills me when that happens. So it's not, I have a lot of stuff, but it's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It is far from that. And I have a lot of all nighters where I'm like, oh crap. With stronger language, I don't know what your listening audience is.
Sorry to break the fourth wall, but we sound really good right now. Just saying.
Awesome.
I've been just learning how to work this board. Like we just took over Nine Story Podcast. We got all this equipment, and I've never used a mixing board in my life. And so, like, I'm like, what's this do? And all of a sudden, wow, it's like magic. We sound so much better now.
Cool.
We found the right knobs.
I found the gain knob here, and it's working like a charm. Jeanette sounds fantastic.
You can actually hear me this time, and we couldn't figure out why. I'm like, I'm projecting. Why can't you hear me?
I'm just, it wasn't her fault. It was the stupid knob.
It's true.
The knob was being a knob. That's all it is.
So... I'm curious, Trisha, at about how far back did you finally like find this rhythm that kept you in such a creative mode?
Well, that's a really good question. I wouldn't say it's a great rhythm. Like I said, I have these moments of like really like manic times, mm-hmm. and then times where I'm like, I think I'm dead. Wait, no, I'm thinking, so I can't be dead. but it's something that it's very slowly evolved over the years. Like in college, I was always a last minute type of person. Mm-hmm. So learning that I needed strong deadlines was something I picked up in mm-hmm. college. In high school, you don't really notice that. In college, you do. I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, wait, I've got a deadline. Well, crap.
Yep. All nighter.
So giving myself multiple deadlines does that. I'm still working on finding a balance where when I do have my crash days, it's not nearly as bad. Because when I do have a crash day, mm-hmm. I am like, I don't talk to me. There's nothing that can fix this day. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I had picked up that happens is because I keep things so tight, mm-hmm. if I have like a big catastrophe, like there's an illness, there's someone needing me, like a family emergency, it's like dominoes mm-hmm. and it'll screw me up for 1-2 months, sometimes more, depending on how big the catastrophe is, mm-hmm. because it's just hard to manage emotionally and mentally all of that when you focus on when, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
So it's still an evolving thing, and I still have my share of failures, but I think they're getting much fewer and far between.
Nice. I know exactly what you mean. I feel like I'm kind of in that mode right now where I'm like, wow, I have this huge pile of stuff to finish where people like are counting on me with deadlines and stuff, but I dropped the ball somewhere, and I don't know where it rolled.
When I get completely off task and I can't get myself righted, I sit there for a second and I start thinking about this song from the animated Hobbit film, which is "Where There's a Whip, There's a Way." I start yes. having that in my repeating in my head, and then I start singing it, and I'm like, "Okay, I'm motivated. Let's do this. Get pumped. Let's write something."
I think I need to just like hang a whip on the wall behind your desk so that you can. You can have that there.
Man.
Just go grab it.
This podcast is going all sorts of places.
I think it's gone places.
Who's steering the ship? You? Yes.
I let go of the wheel. I'm just going to see where this goes. So, Trisha, two of the pieces that you've written that we have, that I've read, that I do want to talk about mm-hmm. is one was Once Upon an Apocalypse, which is... still one of my favorite collections of short stories, maybe ever.
Thank you.
Your story, Steadfast in the Face of Zombies, which was based on the Steadfast Tin Soldier, is just so beautifully heartbreaking. And I still find myself like a year later thinking about that story sometimes.
Thank you. So it's actually still one of my favorite ones that I've written.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. And I love all my babies, but mm-hmm. that one, and that was also a last minute push for me as well, because the two editors and I had been friends and they'd invited me to the anthology and I'm like, all right, yeah. And nothing was like clicking. So I'm like, mm-hmm. all right, I need you to give me a fairy tale that you want. Mm-hmm. And so Rona, one of the editors, was like, all right, Steadfast Tin Soldier, go. You've got 3 days. And I'm
like, talk about deadlines.
And I did do it in 3 days.
Wow.
Including, fortunately, it fell on like a week where I had a critique room meeting. But I was sitting, there's one of the coffee shop cafes where I work with trying to get as much outside accountability as possible. So there's a writer's group in the Worcester area where we just have write-ins. And the point is to go somewhere, sit down, and write. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in the middle of this coffee shop, diner, cafe area, and I'm typing the scene on the submarine mm-hmm. with the two shots, that one right there. And I'm like bawling.
Yeah.
And like, and so someone like taps me on the shoulder. Are you okay?
Aww.
And I'm like, yes, this is just such a hard scene to write. So yeah. So I was like tears streaming down my face when I wrote that. And I'm like, oh, I hope this is as good as I think it is.
It was. That yeah. one made me cry also.
That reminds me of...
It was so tragic and so beautiful.
That reminds me of story with Jeanette when she was in college and she was exhausted.
This is totally unrelated, but I'll tell the story anyway.
It involves crying.
It
so
does
just,
involve crying. That's the only tie. So crying in public places. That's the tie-in. Once upon a time, I was in college and I was only sleeping 3 to 4 hours a night the entire semester. / year. Ooh. Except for Fridays. I would sleep 10 hours on Fridays. That was my one night off. And I got to a point where I was almost to opening night of this one show that I had finished designing. This was the third show of the semester I was working on. I was just working on way too many.
Mm-hmm. Jeanette did theater. So for anybody out there that doesn't pick up exactly what we're talking about.
Sorry. I was in a theater design program. Yeah, it was a lot of sleepless nights. And what I had been doing was designing the set. And I'm in the graduate class for set design. And I'm just, because apparently designing three shows and then going to regular undergrad classes was not just enough. I had to take grad courses. I'm in there and my professor turns to me and says, "So Jeanette, what did you learn about sight lines during this production?" And I just go, "I don't know." And proceed to like... bald bits. And then my professor says, "Shh, it's okay. Just go take a nap in the corner." And for that class, I slept in the corner of the room. So exhaustion is what pushed me there. Not a great story. Just a sad, sad, long series of long nights.
So if Jeanette needs to cry in a scene, I'll just ask her, "Jeanette, what did you learn about sight lines?"
"I don't know." And sight lines, for those of you who might be curious, if you are watching a theatrical play, you can't see what's backstage. Those are sight lines. That's it. I apparently learned nothing. So I had the worst sight lines on that production is what the issue was.
But that's really fantastic that your piece moved you that much.
That is. That while writing that, you had that experience.
And I try to do that. Well, I want to say, I don't know if it was Jim Moore or Chris Golden, but they do a lot of talks around the area. Especially since they've both moved up here now. And one of them was saying is if you're writing and you're not being scared at the scary parts or sad at the sad parts, then you might want to rethink that part. Mm-hmm. So, but at the same time, because I'm writing it and there's also this ego, like mm-hmm. you're just crying because you know you want it to be sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just, your heart's elevated just because you think you want it to be scary.
I think it does. It was said genuinely a moving piece. Mm-hmm. And
thank you.
Like you really, I mean, I didn't remember this fairy tale. Jeanette had to remind me of this fairy tale. I did hear about it, but it's been such a long time that I really didn't remember it. So she's like, I'm like, what does this mean? What is this tin soldier story? And so she explained it to me. And then I was still very much moved at the end of the piece, regardless of where it comes from. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was great because I think that some of the best drama, people don't end up making it at the end, but you still feel okay with that. You know, I think some of the, especially in horror, when somebody doesn't make it to the end, but you still are okay with it, the way it feels satisfying, regardless, mm-hmm. Because it's not some traditional storybook ending, because horror mm-hmm. isn't that, you know, it's unpredictable. Right.
Yeah, that's why I go for the dark too.
Yeah,
because there's going back to my lit classes. There's a sense of catharsis, and I think when you look at the tragedies, you've got that feeling. But with horror, it's a catharsis of the things that you fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when someone doesn't make it, it's kind of a release as well. I mean, it's horror. It's horrible. And mm-hmm. you feel bad. But, like, you also get this immense, almost euphoria right after
mm-hmm.
that just kind of pushes you. And that's why I tend to go with so much dark stuff. And I have, okay, I don't have a George R. R. Martin body count in my pieces, but I have a fairly large body count when looking at all of my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
yeah.
So what was one story? You don't have to tell us the character you kill off, but what was one story where there is a character that you loved that you just horribly murdered?
Okay. That's a tough to pick one because there's two I'm working on that haven't come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Where one of my beta readers who's helping me with it is like, I hate you because I showed him the scenes. It's a romance and mm-hmm. one of the partners just doesn't make it. And he's like, I love you and I hate you because I know it's going to happen. So there's that one. And then for the children's book that I'm working on now, I wasn't expecting to kill any characters,
mm-hmm.
but it was an all of a sudden, oh, you're going to die, aren't you? Yes. Yes, you are. And it's a kid's book and I kill a character.
I like that you approach the, like I read, I have it next to me. The Kelpie. I don't know why I blanked on it. I read the Kelpie, which is amazing and everyone should go buy it regardless of what reading level they are. But that one was like, it was exactly the kind of book that as a young reader I was drawn to initially, because it had that just like a legitimately terrifying sense of danger and kids. Like it's still like kids are still having fun. They're still exploring. There's still this magic to what they're experiencing, but it's terrifying like, at the same time.
You can curse, honey, it's fine.
I'll bleep myself out.
No. Okay. It sounds so much natural.
So
say it with vigor,
dear audience. It's fucking terrifying. There you go. The Kelpie.
Doesn't it
written for middle schoolers? It scares the pants off of you.
It always makes me giggle when Jeanette curses because she doesn't curse very often. So when she says it doesn't sound angry. It always sounds like giddy and angry at the same time, like some kind of weird mix of the
unless
two.
I'm playing video games, in which case I sound like I'm about to kill someone with a controller.
Anything with Mario and she's gonna throw the controller.
I will actually murder someone. Jeanette, do you need help with that platforming? Fuck you.
Yeah, that does happen sometimes. She's so we've been like losing days on end with The Legend of Zelda, the new game that came out recently, and Jeanette usually doesn't play these kind of games.
Nope.
Or games in general. Like the last one you played through was, what was it? Undertale.
Undertale.
Undertale, yeah.
And that was last year about this time.
And that was an interesting game. But like Zelda, like Jeanette's just been losing herself. And then I'll come. It's like my dad when he used to play Metroid on the NES. And he'd be like, he's like, there's parts of that game where you can get stuck down a pit and there's almost no way out. And if you die, you're like stuck there. Like, mm-hmm. there's just no way out of it. And so my dad would just, like, start cursing like a sailor and be like, everybody get out of the room until I finish this.
You know, I cannot filter myself.
Yeah.
I am, however, curious about where the Kelpie came from. And I know you have at least one sequel, right? Or is there more now?
Yes, there's one sequel. It's called The Earl's Child. The publishing horror story behind that, though, mm-hmm. is that the publisher got bought out and they're not continuing the series. And there is some discrepancies in some of our royalty statements. Because I'm trying to work through that, I don't want to say more.
That's fair.
But yeah. So, but it is there. If you see me at a convention, it would be really cool if you bought it from me as opposed to other sources, because then I know I'm getting the money.
Yeah.
Just so everybody directly contact her for this book.
We will. Yeah.
If you email us and say, I want a copy of this book, or email Trisha, we'll figure that out so that you actually get money.
And I will sign
Trisha.
It and draw pictures in it for you, too.
She does. It's cool.
Yeah. So that and Earl's Child. And it actually came about, so I have a horse now, mm-hmm. but I worked in horse rescue for about 10 years before that. And so when you're dealing with horses, they're beautiful, they're gorgeous, and they're fucking terrifying. So there was a gelding, he wasn't a gelding, he was a colt, and he was too sick. So since we're dropping the F-bomb, I can go be for a little it. More graphic.
Sure.
His testicles hadn't descended.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So he was also a stallion, but getting big. And stallions uh-huh. are dangerous unless you're trained to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this one time I was walking him, we didn't do much with him. Like, the idea was to walk them and socialize them and brush them and remind them that humans can be good people, can be good.
Mm-hmm.
But our neighbor across the way had two new mares.
Uh-oh.
And one of them must have been in heat or something. Because the second he got out of the barn, he's on a lead rope. And the lead rope, you've got like 7, 8 to 10 feet on that.
Uh-huh.
And I'm walking him. And he smells and he like takes off and like rears and
oh
is
gosh.
Like just I'm like I am going to die in this moment. I am going to die.
Oh no.
So I gathered my breath and finally got him under control, because they do give us a fair amount of training.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you make them turn and keep having them turn and do circles.
Yeah.
And then I got him back into the barn. There were no injuries.
Good.
Just, you know, my heart almost beating out of its chest.
Uh-huh.
And like, wow, that was probably the most terrifying moment in my life. And then while I was writing Kelpie, when I was trying to figure out the ending, I had, I got run over by a horse.
Oh no.
I had just gotten my horse and she was staying at a barn.
Uh-huh.
And I had taken my mother-in-law and I brought my horse in, and I asked my mother-in-law to close the barn door, not realizing it was really heavy and I'm stronger than most people assume, stronger than I realize.
Uh-huh.
So she was having a hard time closing the barn door. And so the horse was like a 4-year-old. So that's, you know, for a human equivalent, like between 10 and 12, like kid. Mm-hmm. Now, this horse was a cross between a Percheron and a Clydesdale. And if you don't know what those breeds are, imagine the Nazgul horses uh-huh. with their shoulders over your head.
Whoa.
Pure black. Giant puppy dog horse comes bursting through this narrow hallway of the barn. And I'm like, again, I am going to die.
Uh-huh.
I let go of my horse, because that's the best thing to do in that situation, because uh-huh. you're just going to hurt more people. So she goes to a far corner,
mm-hmm.
and this horse is like bounding like a giant Labrador. I fall backwards. She grazes my ankle and grazes my ribs, breaks the ribs.
Yeah.
Ankle probably had a hairline crack in it or something.
Ooh.
Grabs an entire bale of hay and starts frolicking outside.
Oh, no.
It sounds both fun and terrifying.
Yeah.
Yes.
Were you laughing, but also in pain at the same time?
Yes. And the my adrenaline was so spiked
yeah.
that I did not even feel the pain in my body
uh-huh.
until I was halfway home in the car.
Wow.
And by then I'm like,
all of a sudden it's getting really hard to breathe.
Yes, exactly.
Is it hot in here?
So that got worked into some of the scenes.
Yeah.
And then the opening scene with the two horses of Kelpie actually came from a horse training book by Monty Roberts, who mm-hmm. the movie The Horse Whisperer was based off of. Now, when you have two stallions meet, they hate each other and they want to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a given, because, you know, you're either going to try and kill the other one and take their mares, or you've got to kill the other one before he comes in and takes your mares. And so the posture that I described with them hunched down
yeah.
and that creepy crawly thing.
Yeah.
I saw one of them do, one of the geldings do that when we had a new one. I'm like, that is fucking creepy.
Yeah.
To
is.
See a horse move like a predator.
Whoa. I need to find a video of that and add that to our show notes, because I've never
yeah.
seen that. I didn't know that was a real thing.
It is. And that's like, I totally need to include that when the two stallions are facing off, because ugh, you get shivers.
Oh, man.
is there a term for that?
Not off the top of my head that I know.
Look up like two stallions and creepy crawl horse. I bet it'll pop up.
Yeah. I don't have actually lent the book to the barn where I have my horse, mm-hmm. so I can't go grab it and flip to the chapter. So, but it's in Monty Roberts' From My Hand to Yours, and it's one of the opening chapters. We'll so reading worst behavior books is a great way to give yourself nightmares.
Apparently.
And Jeanette, Trisha, for the audience, why don't you give everybody a little bit of a description of what Kelpie is all about?
Kelpie is the story, it's based on Scottish mythology of Kelpies, mm-hmm. which are child-eating fairy horses that live in bodies of water. Some stories have them in the ocean, some in lochs, some in between. And Scotland is full of evil water fairy, but the Kelpie appears like a horse. Kids are like, ooh, a horse! And they climb on its back, and it drags them underwater and eats them. So the story of the Kelpie is about an 11-year-old girl and her best friend, who happens to also be a prince in England, thinking that they're going to do a better job than the police to figure out where some missing kids have gone. And they manage to piss off the Kelpie. And adventures and trying to fix the situation ensue.
Perfect.
Thank you. I adore this book.
Thank you.
Everyone needs to buy a copy from you. Specifically.
Thank you.
And since we didn't mention Once Upon an Apocalypse, which everyone should also go run and buy a copy of, is a bunch of fairy tales retold as zombie apocalypse stories. So if you like zombies, fairy tales, or just being terrified or heartbroken, read that book.
And Trisha's one of the Trisha's one of the authors on that. It's an anthology.
It is an anthology.
Yes.
It's a really, and I enjoyed reading it myself. So I'm really happy to share those pages with the authors that are in there.
Yeah.
So
it was a really fantastic collection.
Thank you.
What have you been making lately? What was that face, Alex?
Because you were telling me before the difference between a collection and an anthology.
Oh, yes. I apologize.
I got a book slap
on
the wrist.
It's an anthology. Yes. I apologize. Mm-hmm. This is an anthology because there are multiple authors with multiple stories. A collection is one author, multiple stories. Y'all are now better educated than my brain. You're welcome.
Air high five to everybody. Air high five.
And off of that tangent, Trisha, you had a huge list of things that you're just currently coming up / just came out. Let's hear about them.
So coming recently out, I'm another anthology that I'm really proud to be a part of is the New England Horror Writers put out Wicked Witches, which I have a story poem in there based on Puritan ideas of women. And I really loved it. And I had a great time reading that one out loud because it's wicked creepy.
Nice.
So I have a story. I have a story poem in that. And that also amazing selection of authors in this anthology. Also out in October is I did a novella with Pole to Pole Publishing called Tea with Mr. Fuzzy Pants. And the reviewers say it's safe for kids. I had not intended it. So I will put I think parents should read it before handing it to their children. But that was a story where in my head I wanted to play with almost a magical realism and poor parenting decisions and stuff like that. So the tagline for that, which I love, is inviting a dead bunny to tea wasn't dad's first mistake.
Wow. So. That just says so much already. It's a sentence. Good job.
Thank you. So I love that one because I've had rabbits all my life too. And rabbits are also evil little creatures. So I adore them, but they're evil. They're just, they're not for their weak of heart.
Out of curiosity, what about rabbits is so terrifying?
They're smart.
Yeah.
They figure out problems. They demand you respect them even more than cats do.
Oh.
So my current rabbit, Vash, who's a mix, He's a 10-pound monstrosity. And he will come up to you and he will yank at your ankles and put his head down. And if you don't pet him, he will bite your ankles. My two rabbits before that, Miss Retta and Loki, I did not name him. I generally know better than to name any animal Loki, but, you know, they would work together and move chairs so they could get onto the kitchen table and shove all the fruit or flowers or whatever was on there to the floor and eat it. And they would frame each other for when they were doing stuff they knew they weren't supposed to do.
It wasn't me. It was the other one.
Exactly. It's hilarious and creepy. And also, if you've ever seen a rabbit eat a strawberry or raspberry.
Yeah, it is legitimately freaky.
I used to have a, I think it was like a gerbil or a hamster. I think it was a hamster. And it, you know, like in The Secret of NIMH when Mrs. Frisbee is like unwrapping the wire and getting out of the cage and then cuts herself and all that. So we had like a bird cage. We used to have finches. My parents used to have finches. And then when we got rid of the finches, they either flew away or we gave them to friends or whatever. My mom didn't like the feathers everywhere. She hated the dander and feathers and whatever. So we got a hamster and we put it in the bird cage and we cleaned it all up and it was all, you know, fresh and had water in there. But the hamster would lift the latch, like the sliding door. We took like twisty ties and we tied each of the doors for the food and the water and the main door with twisty ties. And then I saw the hamster stick its hands out of the bar, grab the freaking wire and unwrap it. And I was like, holy crap. Like a friend of mine used to have one that he used to call Houdini. And he would put like, he'd put it like under a cup over it. And then he'd lift the cup and he was just gone. Like, they didn't know how the hell he got away. And, you know, it was just like, these, I don't know.
People underestimate animals.
Miss Retta, who was my first rabbit, I was constantly changing additional locks on her cage. And it was a tough one where you actually had to push it in and down. She had that down pat when she thought we weren't looking. I was hiding and she didn't see me. And I saw her open her mouth all the way and pull it in and down and come out.
And I'm done here.
Yep.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was just very curious because I think of rabbits and I'm like, well, they're cute, right? Apparently, most of the
time. They're vicious. They also attack. They're very territorial.
Oh,
yeah. So I had Vash and his brother, and I had to separate them for a long time because they would go at each other. And Miss Retta, who was a little 5-pounder, went after everybody if she didn't like them. And
really?
I had my foot on the floor, and she thumped on it, looked at me, and peed right on my foot.
Oh, no. Oh, she was pissed. She's
making eye contact the whole time.
Yeah. Wow. Don't piss off a rabbit, guys. This is what we learned today.
That's pretty much now. And so now I've had, so I also have I'm working on one. I haven't put it out yet. So now I've had my evil horse. I've got my evil bunny. I have a cat and I recently finished writing and in edits for a futuristic sci-fi cat dystopia, where cats are all genetically modified and you have gen mod cat shows.
Ooh.
And the cat also is extremely smart and extremely evil in that, because I have this theory that continues to be supported in all of my animals. The smarter they are, the more evil they are. Quite honestly.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think humans can be so evil?
Exactly. I mean, if you look at the animals that are closer to us in intelligence, their capacity for horrible things that they actually do in nature is massive. Like dolphins, orca whales, they have gangs, they're rapists, awful things.
Yep. The more you know. Intelligence equals violence. So when you write, you write a lot in horror, as I've seen. Do you, and it sounds like you kind of flutter into other genres as well. Which ones do you find the most satisfying?
Mixes between, basically, I actually find myself almost equally at home in fantasy and horror. Mm-hmm. So when I can combine the two, that's my happiest. So if I do fantasy, it's still going to be dark and horrible things are going to happen. And then my horror usually tends to have fantastic elements in it. And Scott didn't leave the lights on. Sorry. Sorry.
I thought it was a critter. Hi, human.
I didn't realize that my husband came home and I didn't realize he had turned the lights off and locked the door.
Oh, that works.
All right. So yeah, mostly I'd stay in like fantasy and then that ends up turning into horror because I don't know, I have horrible, evil things in my mind and I exercise them by writing them on the paper.
You're too intelligent to be nice.
I found that with most horror authors is they're extremely smart, extremely nice, like sweet, nice, kind, giving people. And the reason for that, I believe, is that we write some of the most horrific and awful things and we put it all on the paper
and then we share it.
Exactly.
yes
this is totally fine. Me all you like.
I just watched I just went and watched the film Get Out. I don't know if you've heard of that film.
Oh, I have not seen it yet, but I want to.
There's a concept in the film and when you see it you'll know what I'm talking about. It's called the sunken place. And
okay.
And when I saw the film and I saw that part of the film and they were explaining that, it reminded me quite a bit of my own writing when it, because I write in this kind of disconnected way where I'm like somewhere else. And because when I write my stuff, it's very nightmarish. Some of my things, there's just kind of like this, it's like disconnected. Like I'm like an out of body experience and like you're not in control.
Right.
And so when I watched the film, it really, really connected to that part of my writing. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Like, that's really kind of, if I could explain how I write or why I write that way in, you know, exercising that horror from my own nightmares and personal experiences and all that, it would be equated to that concept of the sunken place. When you see that, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. And I'm extra excited to see the film.
I haven't seen it yet either. So that's definitely on my list of things I want to hear. I saw that you were also saying that you've written a lot of dark poetry lately, and I'm very curious, one, about how you approach writing poetry, so I'll start there. How do you approach that?
Okay, I tend to write poetry in fits and spurts, where something will hit me emotionally, and it'll like hit the button in my head that's like, write poetry. And I'll write like 3 to 6 poems, just blah, and I can't think of anything else. And when I'm thinking in like a verse and a rhythm. So that happens. And then I'll go for sometimes 3, 6 or more months and not do any poetry. And then I'll be inspired to go back and look at the other stuff. So I had an opportunity recently with the Blackstone Valley Art Association to be paired with an artist. And what we were doing is we would meet and then we would each do an initial piece. And then the artist I was working with was a photographer. So he would take the poem that I wrote and find and create a photo based on that. And I would take the photo he sent me and then go and write a poem on that. And my poetry tends to reflect, again, it's more emotional. And one of the things when it comes to all the writing, because I do poetry, short fiction, medium fiction, and giant ass novels. So in each of those, the story has its own medium. And one of the things that when I was studying journalism in college is that the medium is as much part of the message as the message of the medium. And so if I have an idea, I know if it's supposed to be a poem or if it's supposed to be a short story. Sometimes I can wrestle one into the other, but it needs to be something shorter. Even with my longer poems, that those are like a short story idea. And they just come out with the rhythm. And the fact that you have rhythm and pauses or a refrain is part of the story itself. So it needs that. So when I know, once I get my brain worked on poetry, the ideas that fit a poetic medium start coming. So I suppose it's not a surprise that I was kind of in a dark place this past fall. And that's when I got assigned this whole thing. So that all just got worked into it, and it's more deeply emotional mm-hmm. and like theoretical. It's a poem to me is not as concrete as a short story. It's for the stuff that you can't really explain. So that all got worked into it. And after I had met the person, I just had even more ideas mm-hmm. just of things that were either annoying me or scaring me or making me very sad or amusing me. So it's more those emotions that'll say, okay, this needs a poem, because the strongest element of it is the emotion. And by having a poem that doesn't fit a story arc necessarily, that can encompass the emotion even more. I don't know if that makes sense.
That does make sense. 'Cause like sometimes I'll write poetry as well, and it often also tends to be dark because horror is our favorite thing.
Yeah.
Alex as well writes a lot of poetry, and I think you're right. Like, it's poetry is so much more motivated by a moment, by like a breath, by an emotion than it is mm-hmm. by anything else. And I've been really just kind of wondering lately, like, why is it sometimes a poem comes out, like, why do I couldn't really articulate why I feel like poetry is so important and it doesn't get enough attention a lot of the time, but I do feel it's important. And I think it is because it isolates the emotion and it allows you to really just address that without being like going into mm-hmm. a full novel about explaining just this one thing you felt.
Yeah, because with a novel or even a short story, you have to deal with all the aspects of setting and character development and plot movement. Mm-hmm. With a poem, you can take the time to explore the emotion behind it from many different views. Mm-hmm. And you do that with the word choice, with the sentence structure, with the rhythm of each sentence. And part of, I love punctuation and I love grammar, which is totally nerdy and geeky. But when you study that and learn the rules of it, when you get to writing a poem and you specifically choose to follow or break those rules, then you can look at it a different way. It's like breaking open a stick and looking at the rings.
As a writer myself, like, I write for the blog every week, and it gives me accountability that I have to write something, whether it be a short horror story or a poem or something. And depending on where I am emotionally or focus wise, if I can't get a story out, I'll crank out a poem. Mm-hmm. But I do get something really emotional and punchy out of it, you know, 99% of the time. But I wanted to know your process when you're writing a poem. What do you typically do, or where do you typically pull from?
With a poem, normally I write anything else with music in the background. Mm-hmm. I can't do that with poetry. So I turn off music, and that kind of gets me in the mindset because of the rhythm of the poem. And usually I'll do a first draft of a poem in one sitting. And that kind of has to be done in one sitting for me, just to get it all out and kind of puke it onto the keyboard. And then I do a lot of editing on it. And I read it out loud over and over. Like, I read my short stories and all my other stuff out loud too, because I think that's the greatest thing a writer can do to proofread themselves. Mm-hmm. With a poem, I read it like I'm performing it. Mm-hmm. And I'll actually pull up like Audacity or something and listen to it play back.
Yeah.
And I think poems to me in a sense are harder than the prose, mm-hmm. because with prose, every sentence has to do like double duty. Mm-hmm. With a poem, every word and piece of punctuation is doing double, if not triple duty. So that's what it is. So I'll analyze each word choice. And then I have a few friends who are specifically poetry people, and I'll share with them. And like, I have one of my writers groups has a few poets in it, and I'll save it and bring my poetry to that writers group. So it goes through a lot of iterations.
I can see that. And I actually do the same thing when I write poetry. I have to perform it out before I feel like it's good. I'll write it in one go through, rewrite, mm-hmm. read it, rewrite. And then I'm like, okay, I have a poem.
Yes.
Do you find you work within any other than like a certain rhythm? Do you have any in like particular structures you like to work with? Like, the only thing that is popping into my head right now is iambic pentameter, which is Shakespeare's style of writing things, but there's lots and lots of different types of structures for poems. But I'm curious, is there any that you find yourself drawn to?
Most of my stuff is free verse that I have its own meter to, mm-hmm. but some poems come to me and inform me very soundly that they need to be a particular thing. So I have one that is in iambic hexameter.
Oh.
Couplets. ABAB. Mm-hmm. That specific. And then for the children's book that I'm working on now. So I did this as a NaNoWriMo mm-hmm. project. It was in my head. I love it. It's called The Circus Under the Bed. and my plug line for it is if Monsters, Inc. and The Borrowers were told via Neil Gaiman. And as I started to write it, poetry kind of attacked. And I'm like, this is NaNoWriMo. I don't have time for poetry. But no, it wouldn't leave me alone. So mm-hmm. I ended up writing several poems as world building.
Nice.
Which was cool, but also annoying as fuck. Because these ones had to be, they told me that they had to be a particular rhythm.
Uh-huh.
And rhyme scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. And that was so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And then for each of the particular types of creatures that lived under the bed, they had, now when I'm doing NaNoWriMo in my head, I was like, oh, I'll just write a little sonnet for them. But then I looked at it and they're not sonnets. They're missing four lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I call them nonnets.
I mean, that seems appropriate. A monster gets a nonnet, not a sonnet.
Yeah. Yeah. And so all of them are in that particular form.
Oh, that's fun.
And yeah. So, and then I edited one of them to send separately from the piece. It was standalone. It's standaloneable.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, I went back and forth with one of my poetry beta readers to really hammer it because it just wasn't working. And one of the things that I love when you have trustworthy beta readers, be it poetry or prose, they know to ask you questions. So her suggestion for how to fix it didn't work, but the way she asked the question and what she thought was a good fix made my head wrap around, oh, wait, no, this is what I need to do. I need it to be, and that one did end up being iambic pentameter with a break, and it has an odd rhyme scheme.
Nice.
Because there's a mid break where it needs to rhyme with circus under the bed, all the last lines.
You know, a nonnet sounds like the punchline of a bad joke. Like there's like a whole bunch of writers in a dark room, and somebody says, "Who wants this really hard, you know, assignment?" And everybody goes, "Nonnet."
Nonnet, and then the one person who didn't like speak up goes, "Ah, damn it! I have to nonnet." Again, out of curiosity, so many of my questions are out of genuine curiosity. Do you have any resources, books, poets that you would recommend to people who want to learn more about really getting into learning about actually structuring their poetry a little bit more?
That's a good question. I do have the Webster Rhyming Dictionary.
Nice.
That's kind of a necessary thing, even though most of my poems don't rhyme. That was just, I had it the whole time while I was writing all the poems that required rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
I am a huge fangirl of Linda Addison. I met her at Icon some years ago, and she read her, it was like one of her first, it was before she won her first Stoker. And her poetry, like, I told her this after many drinks at another convention. Your poetry broke my brain in the best possible way.
Nice.
So I love her stuff, and I would highly recommend all of hers. Other poetry. There's a lot of local poets in the Worcester area, so mm-hmm. I just read them. I go to poetry readings, and I watch them on YouTube, too, because that gives me an idea of performance.
Yeah.
So because part of poetry for me is not just reading it, as I want to imagine myself performing it.
Mm-hmm.
So watch other people, see what you like. Poetry, I think even more than prose, is very much what do you like?
Yeah.
What moves you?
Yeah, I used to go to some slam poetry things in Hartford, Connecticut, and then I started being a part of open mics, and I did a couple of open mics that I created where I would perform along with other people, and I really found that to be so helpful because sometimes on the page, something sounds dead to me or not interesting, and then I'll read it, and it sounds so much more interesting read aloud or performed. And I just think it tends to keep, you know, bring it to life. And I like the concept quite a bit of slam poetry because it's super personal. And you're in a room with a bunch of strangers and people are doing these really deep personal pieces. And they're almost like exercising the negative. There's a one guy who was talking about his abusive stepfather. And he would look out like he's looking at a spotlight above the audience. And he would do his piece. And by the time he was done with the piece, he had this huge smile on his face. And it's almost like he's just letting all that negative out. And he's taking all the applause and all the positive energy in the audience into himself and pushing out all the negative. And he looks super happy. He's like bouncing around afterwards, talking to people. And I'm like, that's awesome. I want to do that.
Yes. And no, I agree. There's huge feeling of like when you do perform, just this rush of this change of emotions. Because I said, most of the stuff I do is dark. So I'm like putting it out there and I'm putting myself in the poet person with my voice and all of that. And it just, it is, you have that movement and it's amazing.
This is where we have you on Skype that I can see this little statue of a unicorn above your head in the background.
Yes.
And it I think we had the exact same one in our short film Never Say Goodbye on our website.
Yeah, but that's a bigger version.
Is it a bigger version?
That's a bigger version.
I'm gonna send you a link to that, to our short. It's a short.
There's actually a collection of them all up there.
They're really
cute. And
then
the My Little Ponies all the way over.
Nice.
Yeah, we did a horror web series, and there was a one called Never Say Goodbye, and it was set in an antique shop. And so we bought a few things that we were going to break that's going to happen because of the ghost. You know, the girl gets scared by the ghost and she breaks and she happens to admire this little porcelain unicorn. And then she's staring at it and then she gets scared and she drops it and it breaks. And it's, I don't know.
And he sees a porcelain unicorn.
So maybe that would horrify you because you like those things.
So Alex's collection, Alex, duck your head for a second. So she can see your collection. Duck your head for a second. You see just the beginning of his Amiibo collection.
Oh, cool.
There's a lot of them.
Nice.
Jeanette got these really cool baseball bat cases that she put them in.
It goes further,
Yeah.
They look pretty badass on the wall now. I'm really proud of my decorating of your knickknacks, Alex.
Yeah, so there's the shelf you see above my head actually goes all the way around the room.
Nice.
And like has all of our cool things that we've collected.
That's awesome.
Up there. And my husband put that up after we took over the house and moved in.
That's one thing that I really want to do as a series is like, so there was an artist who went to other artists' studios and then recreated their studios in miniature. I think it would be fascinating to see what writers surround themselves with, because I feel like all of us, we don't like rooms that are just clean and neat and organized.
No.
So many of us seem to just collect things and surround ourselves with all sorts of stuff. So I'm sorry, we got totally off topic.
Yeah.
But that happens a lot on The Ninth Story. We're just like, tangent. Ooh. So Trisha, now that we're back on topic, where can people stalk you in a way that you will find pleasant?
I am on Facebook. Under both Novel Friend and Trisha J. Wooldridge. I'm doing better about actually updating my Trisha J. Wooldridge page.
Nice.
I keep promising I'm going to pick up blogging again, but I do have a regular website, which is anovelfriend.com. And let's see. Those are probably the best ways to get me online, and I'm usually pretty open to, if I've met you in person, like I'll give you my card, and I'm open to getting emails and stuff too.
Nice.
Do you do the Twitters at all?
I have a Twitter account. It's at Novel Friend, but I don't use it as often as I should.
That's fair. It's hard to juggle multiple platforms.
We'll share this episode with you on that and then in other places as well. So
we'll also tag you on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
That'll be fine.
Thank you.
But cool. yeah, thank you so much for talking to us. I know you're super busy with all of these things that you've been creating and all of the stuff that you do, but I just wanted to talk to you. You're just fascinating.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be on your show, and then I love meeting you guys at Rock and Shock too. Yeah. So I was very happy to do this.
Yeah.
This was a lot of fun.
It was.
Geeking about books and poetry, oh my.
Yes.
It's all good. Along with the song we sang for you that you didn't hear. Cool. So, yeah, everyone, thank you for listening to this interview with Trisha J. Woldridge. You are J. Woldridge, right? Or did I add that? Ooh.
No, it's, I go, most of my publishing is so if you know that I think it's child friendly, it's under TJ Woldridge.
Oh.
If I'm not sure if it's child friendly or not, I'll publish it as Trisha J. Woldridge.
Now you know, TJ equals PG.
Trisha J., if your kids get the jokes, it's not my fault.
That's you being an awesome parent and sharing too much too young.
That's what cartoons tell us, too.
It's true. Most cartoons, there's all sorts of jokes that you're not going to get as a kid that you totally get as an adult. And you're like, whoa.
That is so true.
Innuendo much?
Yes.
Outro.
This podcast has been brought to you by the sponsorship of Rode Microphones. They made it possible for you to hear our voices every week. Thanks, Rode. And if you also need to record things and have other people hear what you are doing with your mouth or musical instruments, I don't know, then you should go to Rode.com, R-O-D-E.com.
We just figured out how to turn the knobs correctly on the board. It's awesome.
Hey, that's not Rode's fault.
Thank you so much, Rode, for sponsoring our podcast. And thank you for listening to our show. You guys made it to the end. You are awesome. You get 10,000 banana stickers.
10,000 banana stickers. Good job.
What are those bananas from Zelda? What are they called?
Mighty bananas.
Mighty bananas. You get 10,000 bunches of mighty bananas in Zelda.
So your potassium is going to be out of control.
If you want to find us, you can go either to podcast.ninthstory.com or you can find us on Twitter at Ninth Story Podcast.
That's right. And if you want to read some of the stuff that we are doing, then you can find it on horrormade.com because that's where we put most of our stuff.
That's HORRORMADE.com.
Hey, guess what?
What?
You made it to the very end of the episode.
I said that already.
I don't care. Now you get to be rewarded with the songs we sang to Skype testing. You're welcome.
Please record a message. Afterwards, your message will be played back to you.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
I want to order Chinese food.
And then I want it fast as lightning.
Put it in my belly, put it in my belly.
Why am I still hungry?
Because I ate too much tofu.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
I want to order Chinese food.
You should put that in at the end.
We should get Chinese food.
Put
it in my belly. Put it in my belly.
Can that be the outro this week?
I'm still hungry. If you are able to hear your own voice, then you have configured Skype correctly.